Are you serious about writing a nonfiction book this year? Author Accelerator is offering a nonfiction book incubator starting February 28, 2022. There are only a few seats in this intensive program because you will get one-to-one coaching on every single step of the process, and you will have the chance to pitch your proposal to a pool of agents and publishers at the end. A fabulous opportunity. So, apply for the program at bookcoaches.com/non-fiction-incubator and write that down or check the show notes because this is all kind of under the radar. It's a really small program and you're not going to be able to Google it. Every applicant gets a strategic session with Jenny Nash to kickstart your work. We think Jenny and her book coaches are terrific. So apply for the program and tell her we sent you.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay.
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is #AmWriting, the show about writing mostly all the things. Short things, long things, fiction, non-fiction, fiction. Non-fiction? Yeah, we're not going to talk about fiction. essays, pitches, proposals. This is the weekly podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation. And you can find my work at The New York Times and The Washington Post and The Atlantic.
I'm Serena Bowen, author of more than 30 romance novels, and you can find me at serenabowen.com.
And I am KJ Dell'Antonia, the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters and the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent, as well as the new novel In Her Boots coming out summer of 2022. And this is pause for the insertion of some form of grand and amazing triumphant music. Episode 300.
I can't believe it. It's really kind of crazy. I made cupcakes for 100.
That's
I don't think we
did
much for 200. 300's pretty amazing. The thing about 300 that I'm particularly proud of is that we've never rerun an episode and we've never missed. So, you know, yay us. I'm very proud of us. Especially since this was the thing where, you know, we're like, we'll do this as long as it continues to be fun and then we'll stop if it's not. And it's continued to be fun. I love it.
I will say, you know, I wish to reserve the possibility of rerunning an episode. Because now that we have 300 of them, there's some good stuff back in there. And it is a goal of mine for 2022 to get back in there and pull out some of our very best stuff. And, you know, I don't know, maybe we'll remix it, maybe we'll recreate it, at least to make a roadmap for people. We had a roadmap because we made last year, I believe it was a goal of 2021 or possibly 2020, to make a website that had easily searchable podcasts on it. But sadly, it turned out to be easily hackable as well. And it just became the endless target of hackers trying to send spam emails, and in the end, I just had to shut it down. There was no, I couldn't save it.
Well, we tend to get the same questions. I think there are a few podcast episodes that I tend to send to people over and over and over again, and those tend to be the agenting ones. Like, how do you get an agent? What do you do to get an agent? How do you find one? What do they do? There are those, and then there's definitely, obviously, the query ones. And so I think it wouldn't be that difficult to pull out the ones that people tend to ask about the most.
There are some super popular interviews. And then there are some interviews that are really useful that you wouldn't necessarily know it from the way I titled the episode when we recorded it. So, yeah, I would love. And if you are a listener and there's something that you remember and loved and want me to sort of add to that highlight list, I would love to hear from you. amwriting@substack.com, because I have finally memorized our email address. Yeah, tell me if there was something that you love that you think people should hear again. That would be great.
That's such a great idea.
Yeah.
We definitely need a greatest hits list.
We do. Yeah. Or if somebody if someone's a producer out there and wants to like remix some stuff, not that our producer wouldn't be happy to do that. But yeah, I don't know. So I've got some hashtag goals around the podcast for the year, but for the moment, it's episode 300, and I believe we were planning to talk about what we have learned from talking to 300 assorted authors and to each other 300 times.
Right, and I owe you my word of 2022.
That's right.
Which actually is a great launch pad for this discussion. Because I finally realized that my word was just so easy to pick and so obvious, and it is WIP, or work in progress. Because I have realized that, you know, the work is supposed to be the thing that I focus on and not the business, and that's fine. But also, I am a work in progress, just like the podcast is. And never forgetting that is really the key to everything we do here. We, you know, as we move forward, we tend to learn the same lessons over and over again, and that's okay. That's kind of the point.
Yeah, we've talked about there. All of a sudden, we'll talk about something and we're like, I think we've talked about this before, but I'm newly realizing it now.
Yeah.
And that's cool. I think that's how we work. So I love that word. I think that's fantastic, or that acronym. I think it's really, really good. And can I add really quickly that I have been thinking a lot about my word, which was evaluate, in terms of like figure out which things are valuable to me, which things are valuable for lots of other reasons. And I said that one of the things I really wanted to do this year was make space for a couple of things that make me really, really happy and that really need to get done anyway, which is home repair stuff. And I have been trying to balance the two, how much I do of that stuff and how much I do of the word work. And I have to say, I'm so happy. It's I got a huge project done. I'm in the middle right now. My hands are covered with paint and spackle. I'm in the middle of redoing now our entryway into our house and just fixing some stuff that was broken that I never got around to fixing. And it's been just delicious to use this word evaluate to say, you know, this is what's valuable to me. Do you guys mind if for a second if I mention my new calendar thing?
Go for it.
That you guys are, have been watching. Okay, so I've been talking about this for a long time. There is a thing called the Everyday Calendar by Simone. And oh, Simone, I'm so sorry about this. I've always said it is Geertz, but it's Geertz, I think. I'm going to look it up. I've heard it pronounced a couple of different ways, actually. She's Swedish. And she created this everyday calendar because she wanted to meditate every day and she wanted to hold herself accountable for meditating every day. So there's actually a picture on my website because I've been writing about what's on my wall and this calendar on this wall in my office that has lots of different stuff on it. And my new calendar is the centerpiece of my new wall. And essentially every single day that you finish whatever it is that your goal is, and for her it was meditating, you get to light up the day. And KJ and Serena were really worried that this was going to put a lot of pressure on me to, you know, write more words or whatever the thing was. And I clarified that every day on my calendar that goes into the Arfilian thing that we all have, every single day at the bottom of the day is a goal. And it's a little like, you know, at the beginning of a yoga class when they ask you to set your intention. That's what I've been doing every day. Like, what's my goal for today? And it could be painting, or it could be my words, or it could be just open the file. And that's been really, really good for me. I take a few minutes in the morning just to sort of figure out what my intention is for that day. And I love it. And so then I get to light up the day on my everyday calendar at the end of the day if I achieve my goal. And every day so far I have. And I love it. I'm so happy with this new system that I have going on.
I feel like I would struggle to not light the light. just owning. Yeah. I'm just owning that I feel like with that big a thingamabobber.
Uh-huh.
Until you do it once. I bet after you sort of break that seal, then it'll be okay.
Yeah.
Because it'll actually look neater if it's not completely lit up.
Yeah. Simone.
Maybe Simone's... at the end of the year, the unlit things will form a message that tells you something.
What's funny is Simone said that it wasn't so much about the lit up days as it was her not wanting to have just one that wasn't lit up. So, and I find that that's similar for me. The other cool thing is at the end of the year, you hold down one of the buttons for like, I think 45 seconds or something. And the whole thing goes whoop, whoop, up and down. And it resets for the whole new year. It's just, it's a beautiful thing. So if you go to jessicalahey.com under blog, you'll see a picture of it because it's there. Or and you can go and
I have
and,
added a link to it in our show notes. Cool. Unfortunately, you can't buy it right now.
Not true. So at Simone's website, it is completely sold out. My parents gave it to me for Christmas, and they managed to snag one at the MoMA store, actually, the Museum of Modern Art. How cool would that be? This is her only product that she's designed and created and built and put out there for sales. It started with a Kickstarter, and it's in the MoMA store. How cool is that? Anyway.
It's pretty cool.
Yes. Yes, I love this thing. Yeah, so what we've learned, and I'll just start off with, you don't have to go up into the very hot rafters and very cold rafters of your house where all the insulation fibers are in order to get an adequate podcasting space. As much as KJ loved coming to my house and climbing up into a crawl space in my attic, you don't have to do that. It was really fun in the summer, too, when we would have to turn the light bulb on to see what we were doing. And then we would roast. We would basically bake ourselves like chickens in the in an oven. It was a really quite an experience there. And you couldn't fully sit up because there wasn't enough room for your head. Maybe we'll put that. I'll resend that picture back to you of us in the eave space of my old house in New Hampshire because it was quite a picture. We found out actually that KJ's office works beautifully, and as long as you hang some things up on the walls to dampen the sound, then you're all good.
Well, you know, the world has changed too.
That's
I think
true.
People are more forgiving. The expectations around podcast sound are different. Not only does everyone not have to sound like an NPR podcast, I think we almost don't even want that anymore. Mm-hmm. Personally, I have a familiarity with the level of background. It's not so much background. There's an ambiance that is within a podcast's traditional noise when it's recorded in the way that the podcasters usually record it. And I find that very recognizable. So when podcasters for something that I'm very fond of change that up, if they don't comment, I still notice. And it doesn't bother me for things to be imperfect or I don't even know that imperfect is the word. They're just different.
I do enjoy the fact that we have crammed ourselves into hotel closets and brought all the pillows in with us to dampen sound. I mean, I like the effort that we put in there, especially at the beginning. I remember we were in a hotel in California for Mom 2.0, and we put all the pillows in there and a duvet and crowded ourselves in the closet. It was very, very fun. But I was a little worried that we'd get locked in the closet like that lady, that story that we've all heard about the audiobook narrator who got stuck in the closet and the only people who could hear her were some German tourists on the other side of the wall. But we survived, and it's been super fun making this thing with you. And then, of course, Serena came on late. Serena, how has this been for you being our guest / now co-host?
It's wonderful. As much as I don't really like to listen to myself talk about business stuff all the time, I'm such a nerd for it, so that it just comes out sometimes, and I'm happy to have that happen right here with you.
Well, and people seem to really like that we have Serena, our constant reminder of, I'm sorry, what's your ROI for that? Why are you putting all that effort into that thing that... that is not going to do anything for you? It's like I get all excited about these ideas of this huge new project I'm going to take on. And then Serena will say, so let me add an opposing view. Or let me get back in touch with reality for a second.
Let's dig down a little deeper into that.
And then I realized, well, that was really a dumb idea. But thank you for reminding me of that, Serena.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Some things are worth doing without ROI, and some are not. There's there's a lesson that we have learned. I would say it's something that I have learned from a podcasty point of view, and maybe listeners have found the same thing, is that the biggest names don't necessarily make the most informative guests. There are people that are sort of endlessly entertaining to listen to, so they make a great, you know, they'll make a great guest. But a lot of the times I feel like the most useful really digging into a topic that we have done come when we interview someone that if I put their name in the, you know, in the title, no one is going to recognize it, or very few people, because those are the people that are doing the thing still.
Mm-hmm. I love like the hustle episodes, or the, you know, how to get work as a freelancer, how to balance and keep your, you know, keep all that stuff. Those hustle episodes of the people who are just digging in and doing it have always been the ones that I love the most. And often they're, you know, with people that, yeah, fewer people have heard of. But we've been so grateful to get big names on the podcast, and that has been a thrill. We've done a whole bunch of happy dances, but I think you're right. I think it's I think there have been some unexpected wonderful guests that it hadn't occurred to us that it was going to be as informative as it is.
I think that I learned to ask people different questions mm-hmm. around that. So, you know, asking David Sedaris how he got started was not a useful exercise for anyone except from an entertainment point of view, which it absolutely was. But, you know, asking if I had him to ask again, I think I might ask something more like, you know, how do you choose the one line of something to put into dialogue rather than to put into, you know, your the sort of descriptive paragraphs, something more, more into the details mm-hmm. of the craft. Because when we listen to someone who's really, really experienced and professional, that's the place where you can still learn something.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I have redone that interview in my head about 1,000 times. And I think now that I'm even more familiar with his work, there are some questions I am dying to ask him that I wouldn't have occurred to me to ask him back then. And they are very much craft questions. It's funny, I just heard him in Rutland not that long ago. And he told, I don't think I've mentioned this, he read an essay that was really dark. And like, I was shocked he went where he went with this essay. And there was almost no humor in it. But it was so good. And watch for this essay when it eventually comes out. And I think he called it Bruised. Like when you...
He has a book coming this spring.
Yeah, maybe. This wasn't that long ago. And he was like, oh, that is... He's like, now that I read that out loud, I realize that needs more humor in it. And I actually tweeted afterwards that I was hoping he wouldn't add more humor to it, because it was so affecting. Like, no one could breathe in that room. And so it's interesting to me, some of the choices he makes, and I would want to talk very specifically about some of the technical choices that he makes in his work. Yeah. Yeah, that would be really fun. I need a redo on that.
That's something we all want, right? Is to write that essay or yeah. that chapter or that scene where nobody can breathe until they get to the end.
Yeah. There's actually, I just wrote, I've been reading Bomb Shelter by Mary Laura Philpott, which is, oh, it's so good. And I've been writing her as I read, with some just really geeky details. Like, there's this incredible, right at the beginning of the book, there's this incredible moment where her son is having a seizure. And she walks in and she talks about the fact that the first thing she sees are his feet. And then she transitions to his birth, and he was a footling breech. And there's just this beautiful moment. And then there's another moment. Technically, I was so impressed with how she did this, where she was saying, let's say you're doing blah, 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 and you do this and you do that. And then she realized I think there was probably a moment when she was writing where she said, oh, shoot, this needs to be in the first person. And she said, and this is like at the end of the second chapter or something, she said, okay, let me just admit it. It's I, but go along with me for the ride. And I wrote to her and I said, that's such a technically challenging thing to do when you're using that second person example, yet you realize you need to revert to some other speaker. And she just owned it and made a joke out of it and then invited the reader in with her. And it was so beautifully done because it is so not what I would have done. I would have been like, oh, shoot, I got to rewrite that whole last section because I can't be switching the voice around. But she did it, and she did it in a really wonderful way. And those are the lovely moments that I like to ask people about. Now I want to ask her that question, which is, did it occur to you to rewrite the whole thing? Did you make the decision? Narratively, that's how you wanted to do it? Or did you just sort of go with the flow? Anyway, those are the kind of questions I love to ask.
That would be very much an easy reading is hard writing kind of question.
Yes.
Which it would be, yeah, I mean.
She's clearly doing some hard writing in that book, but she really does make it look very easy. It'll be out in a couple of months, and oh, it's going to be fantastic. Anything else you've learned, KJ? Can you think of anything? I think we've both gotten better at asking guest questions. And I think both of us have improved in different ways. And that's been really fun too.
I think so too. I think that you are super, really great at having a deep curiosity about why people do the things that they do in their life and their sort of choices around what they do with the work and what kind of work that they do. That's where I see you really shining as an interviewer. And for me, I feel like I have gotten more focused on, okay, I'm saying to myself, I would love to talk to so-and-so, but why? Why do I want to talk to so-and-so? You know, like, what is it about their work makes me want to have them as a guest on the show? And I've been much, much more focused in saying, okay, will you come on the podcast because I would like to talk to you about X? And then, you know, digging into that and realizing too that the thing that I'm curious about everyone tends to be more like, how do you write? When do you do the work? When don't you do the work? When does it feel hard? When does it feel easy? Does it ever feel easy? So it's like, I feel like you come at it in a big mm-hmm. way and I come at it in a sort of a small and detail-y way.
Yeah. So the stuff that Serena tends to ask is always really cool too, because it's always something that she's usually something, Serena, that you're personally curious about. And I think that feels like those are the questions that are fun to listen to as well. I love, because our experiences of writing can be so different, and you have that whole co-writing experience that I just don't really have. I love listening to you ask questions of authors because they're very different from the questions I would ask.
Well, I have always owned that I am not a brilliant interviewer. It's not a strength of mine. And, you know, the fact that I'm able to get in a couple of good ones every once in a while is, you know, I'll take it.
For me, it's
harder than it sounds.
Oh, yeah, I think
right?
It's hard.
That is absolutely something that's absolutely something I have learned by doing this. And when you listen to somebody who's really good at it, you know, on NPR, on another podcast, and it sounds like they're just having a conversation. But then when you do it yourself, you realize, oh, yeah, I know a conversation would be a mistake because no one wants to hear me.
Well,
That's not the point of this.
You make a good point that we all, since we write different things, we have trained ourselves to listen for different cues. So I am in this place where I create a lot of fiction in a year. And so when I look around me and I hear stories, whether they come from the newspaper or a person that I'm talking to, I am thinking about the story arc and what that would be like as a fictionalized, you know, I've trained myself to listen that way. Jess pitches more articles than either one of us these days. And she is listening to the world and thinking about, oh, that would be a great piece here. And that would be here. And this is the question I would ask in that interview. So, you know, you have to realize that whatever kind of writer you are, that you are looking at the world in a way that suits your objectives there. And that's partly why I just haven't ever given a lot of airspace to interviewing as a skill, because it doesn't really fit with my, you know, 9-to-5 goals. Mm-hmm. I was just asked to, apparently at some point I signed up for some kind of alumni contact thing because, and it must not be very popular because I got one email from this Yale alumni organization from somebody who wanted to be a narrative nonfiction writer. And I said, you know, that's amazing. I am not that kind of writer, but here are some people who are, and here's some podcasts you could listen to. But I have learned one thing, which is that if you want to write essays and pitch stories, you have to really love pitching. If you want to be a professional actor, you have to really love auditioning. And so, you know, if there's anything I can offer you about when you're figuring out what kind of a writer you want to be, whether that's short form or long form, you know, take that into consideration and listen to these other smart people who can talk about those things, because the focus, the lens that you will apply to the people in your life, you know, will have to be one of these choices. You know, we all have to specialize. Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the things that I wish we could talk about more, and one of the reasons that I loved the book Scratch, and I love the people that are willing to be really honest, especially around things like speaking and what you get paid and stuff like that, is that I think the more informed all of us are, the more help that, you know, I want to be as helpful as possible. That's what this podcast is all about. So I find myself wanting to ask a lot of really nosy questions that they're, you know, KJ and I both at one point early on mentioned how much we got for our first books and, you know, our my first book and her second book, that kind of thing. A lot of people are not willing to talk about that stuff, and I totally get it. And then there's also that line. There's also some territory that I love to talk about, which is, you know, when things go wrong, or we've talked to a couple of authors who have lost their editors or their publisher ghosted them or whatever. And we've had to be really careful. And often we'll talk to the authors ahead of time and say, you know, what are we allowed to talk about? What are we not allowed to talk about? And I so wish that we could find some guests who would be really willing to get in there and talk about the nitty gritty stuff. But then they often, like we do, have agents who are like, really, I wish you would not talk about that on a podcast. But for me, and that's why I'm so grateful for the two of you, is that when something goes wrong and there really isn't anyone else I can talk to about it, I can tell you two, and I know it's, you know, it's in the cone of silence and it's not going anywhere. Because this stuff's hard. You know, this writing business is really hard, and there's a lot of ways that it gets frustrating and gets screwed up. And, you know, with the paper shortage right now, you know, I was really pissed off. I heard about this guy who had a promo for if you bought NFTs, you could get free books. And then it turns out that, like, people just wanted the NFTs. So suddenly they bought like 40 books, and 40 books are going to get printed and probably just sent to a recycling bin. And that stuff pisses me off. But I would love if more people could talk about the stuff that irritates them without getting in trouble for it.
Well, one thing I want to shout out, and I'm going to put a link in the show notes, is that Rachel Herron, who we've talked about a number of times, Rachel is a, she started out as an essayist, and she still is. She is now a thriller writer. She sells her thrillers on pitches. That's not the word I'm looking for. Proposals, which is so unusual. And I love hearing her talk about that. But the reason I'm saying this is she does an annual money episode.
Oh,
and
cool.
She just did hers. So I put a link to it in the show notes. But she says, I made this much from my independently published romance. I made this much from this book where I got the rights back and redid this, and this. And, you know, I got this much as an advance, and I got this much. And it is a super... super helpful thing to listen to. And I think it's important to sort of to talk about some of the reasons that authors don't get up and share these numbers or share the things that are going wrong for them. And I think, you know, on the one hand, no one wants to present an image of being sort of less than positively successful.
Right, right, right.
And some of that is just like a personal protective screen. But some of it is a fear that, you know, people kick the people who are down, or just the idea that if you come on our podcast and say, well, my last agent let me go and I had to get a new one, and you do this before you're sort of back
right,
up high, you're actually going to damage your, you know, your chances. If some agent might listen to this and think, oh, well, you know, I don't want that person. Or similarly, if someone hears, well, you got, oh, I got a $20,000 advance on something and that doesn't sound like very much to them, then when they're making you an offer, they're not going to give you a very big advance. So it gets really, I mean, it's challenging to talk about this stuff when you're in it. And then it becomes easier when it's not really an issue anymore, either because you're so successful or because you've changed what you do or things have just changed for you. But by then, your experience is outdated and it isn't as relatable. So,
yeah, Roxane Gay did it in a podcast or on Twitter. It might have just been on Twitter. And it was shocking how little she had been paid, especially early on. And now she's Roxane Gay and she's getting paid better. But she was doing it in order to talk about inequity in what authors get paid of. And what was fascinating, I think it might have been during that hashtag.
What publishing pays
something
me.
Like. Yeah, something like that. And that was fascinating because some people were brave enough to say, look, you know, you probably have no idea who I am. And I just got paid $300,000 for my last book that went nowhere. And look at, oh, my God, Roxane Gay, you know, got very little for, you know, hunger. Anyway, those conversations are fascinating to me.
And I think, was not brave enough to join that.
No,
I just wasn't.
I didn't either, especially since. Well, and also I don't think a lot of people understand the divide between fiction and nonfiction in terms of how much people get paid and advances versus, you know, not, you know, it's complicated. And I do wish, though, it could be a more open conversation so that people could understand what to expect, especially people who are brand new to the biz. It helps. And, you know, there's always that fun moment. I used to do this with my students all the time where I would take, let's say you get $100,000 for your book. Woohoo! That's a huge amount of money. Now, let's talk about taxes. Let's talk about how much your agent gets. And let's talk about how many payments that's spread out over and the fact that sometimes that could be spread out over 5 years. And my students would always look at me and say, huh. Wow, well, that sounded like a lot of money when you first talked about it.
And then, then there's what that means for your future advances.
Right.
You know, your ability to earn that out or your lack of ability to earn that out. What it is that your publisher will look at when they consider bringing you back in for another book, or what it is a publisher will look at if you want to switch publishers.
Anyway, there's a lot of stuff that's hard to
understand. This is not the world's most fun topic, and I feel like we're not, you know, we're sort of just vague booking it.
At some point we should do this will be as popular to KJ as like a tax episode. We should like take one of my royalty statements and, you know, blank out some of the numbers and do like a deep dive into what I have to show my royalty statements to Serena and she helps me understand them. It's almost like they're trying to make them unintelligible.
Well, it almost
so that
is
I
like
can't.
That, isn't it? I don't disagree. but if you do a little math, you can figure out a lot of things about your royalty statement, including you can kind of figure out what deal your publisher has with the ebook vendors, such as our overlords at Amazon.
We should do that. I'm going to get to work on like taking one of my royalty statements and pulling it into an editing thing so that I could take some of the numbers out. And we'll have to, just for fun, we'll have to do that. That would be fun.
I have a royalty statement right
and it's
here
unopened.
From my first book. It is unopened. Yes, this is from my 2000s. I'm opening it. That's the sound of me opening. This is from my originally published in 2007 or 2008.
Wait, can we take bets?
Reading with Babers.
Can we take bets on the size of the check?
Oh, sure. So, but let me give you the details first. So the book was originally published in 2008. It was Reading with Babies, Toddlers, and Twos. It's co-authored. So any amount of money in this is going to be split between me and my co-author, Susan Straub. It was reissued in 2016. Yeah, I think 2016 with a new book list because it had a lot of book lists. And then we had a third person. But we don't split royalties with her. We just paid her outright. So, yeah. So, this is from that book. And this is this royalty statement. And it is, let's see how many.
Can we ask what your original advance was for that book?
$6,000 split between the two of us.
Okay.
Yeah. One, two, three, four, 6 pages. So I have 6 pages here.
That's a lot
from
of pages.
My publisher. This is not from my agent. I'm opening it up. All right.
I can't even imagine what's on 6 pages, but okay.
That's part of the fun of it. That's what I was getting at. Oh, okay. Well, the 6th page is just like, welcome
legalese,
to our digital
right.
world. So we'll ignore that. So we're at 5 pages of assorted random numbers, conversions, subsidiary rates, earnings, total, agent. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of stuff.
It's 6 pages for the, in the end, the total balance due. And let me try. Okay. Sorry. You're going to make bets.
Okay, Jess.
I'm trying to figure out if this is just for me or if this is the total and then it gets, this is the total.
Okay.
Yeah, this is pre-split.
Okay, okay.
So this is pre-split. I thought you needed that piece of information. All right. So this is for the entire year.
Yeah.
No, 6 months. January 1st, 2021 to June 30th, 2021.
I'll pick a number, Jesse. You can go under or over.
Okay.
Okay. $204. Under,
oh, man.
Under
you
or
went,
over.
You went, you said, KJ, you said that was for both, right?
This is for both of us, yeah.
Okay. I was going to go lower than that. I was going to go like $181.54.
It is $63.01. And it breaks up as follows. In trade paperback, the earnings were $2,222.40. And in ebook, they were $386.42. And... or wait, is that the
total? That's
royalty
the thing. You
yeah.
can't
total
tell.
No. Oh, less original guarantee. So I think we still haven't earned out the second book of this, for which I think we got like $2,000. Yeah.
Well, KJ.
Well, the funny thing is, so I've got this pile of stuff from Sourcebooks, but let me tell you that when I get stuff from Putnam, which is my Penguin publisher, I can totally understand it. It is not mysterious. It is perfectly easy for me to look at it and go, okay, that's how many ebooks they sold. That's how much money I got as a result. Those are not opaque. This, on the other hand, is more than a little opaque. Not that my agent wouldn't be happy to sit down and explain it to me. I'm not dissing. I'm sure Sourcebooks would explain it to me.
We should definitely do that because I also would love to have a conversation about what it means to earn out and what it means for the publisher to be in the black with you versus what it means for you to earn out. As we have said in the past, I still haven't earned out the gift of failure. Yeah, so that's good news in that I got a lot for it in the beginning, and I've sold a whole ton of copies. I've sold a lot of copies, but I have still not earned out that book, so yeah.
See, and here's like a whole nother page of this where I owe them $1.02, and it looks exactly the same as the first page, and the dates are the same.
You got some returns on there somewhere, buddy.
Yeah, they haven't asked me for the dollar
yeah.
at least,
yeah.
so I got that going for me.
Yeah. It turns out that, you know, like music industry contracts that can have some very weird terms in them, like, you know, they still charge artists for the packaging for their stuff, even
really?
When it's, even when there's this really great video, called, I can't remember what it's called, but it's about 30 Seconds to Mars, the music group. And, I'll think of it in a second. And in there, they talk about some of the weird terms in music contracts, and some of them are like packaging, even for digital downloads, which, as we know, have no packaging. So, yeah.
Is that something I can put in the show notes?
I'll look up what it's called. I actually own it.
Okay.
I like the documentary so much that I actually bought it. And it's fascinating because I knew nothing. And it's about 30 Seconds to Mars fighting over the fact that their label said they still owed them like $1 million, even though they had just gotten home from, or $3 million, and they had just gotten home from a tour that made millions and millions of dollars. And it's about the fact that, you know, music contracts are – there's just a limited number and of types that you can get, and they really do take a lot of artists for a ride. So, and it's because, you know, of piracy, and so few, you know, companies can make money. And anyway, it was very interesting. So it's called Artifact, and it's Jared Leto's band, 30 Seconds to Mars. And it's fascinating. It is, whether or not you think Jared Leto is a cult leader, which apparently is a thing now on TikTok, whether or not you believe that, it is a very interesting documentary.
I have no idea who we're talking about.
Okay. That's fine.
Just owning that.
That's yeah. fine.
I got nothing.
You've seen him in movies. I'm so uncool. I'll tell you who he is later. You've seen him in movies. So do we want to talk this week about what we've been reading? Because I've been reading some cool stuff.
Sure.
I have been reading Serena Bowen's new book. I don't know if anyone's heard of her. She's really cool. But I'm listening to the audio as usual. And as usual, I will give Serena feedback on her narrators. I actually just finished a book that I was really, really excited about called The Latinist. And it was, I mentioned it on an earlier podcast. Maureen Corrigan got there before I did. She talked about it on NPR. I just finally finished it, and it is so good. But here's, and I really, Mark Prinz, the author, I hate to do this to you. Read the print version, because his publisher needs to put a little bit more work into the audio production. His audiobook narrator doesn't know how to pronounce a whole lot of words, and I'm not talking about Latin words. So you might want to read the paper version of The Latinist. It's really,
ouch,
really good. Yeah. She's not terrible. She does the voices. She's fine. She, you know, when I was recording my audiobook, we were so fixated, my director was so fixated on my pronunciation that she would like check pronunciation of things while I was going. We called Tulane University to make sure I was putting the emphasis on the correct syllable. And in fact, the person who answered the phone at Tulane University, she said, "I've never thought this hard about how my employer's name is pronounced, and now you have me all mixed up and I don't know how to pronounce it anymore."
Hello, yeah. Tulane University. This is Marjorie speaking.
That was very funny. But this person who did the reading for this book, and I'm clearly not going to mention her name, just needs to make sure that she's done a review of the words and that she knows how to pronounce them before she goes into the booth. That's all I'm going to say about that. But
well,
it's a
that's
fantastic
her producer's
book.
Job. That's yeah. the producer's job.
You know, it's not totally. I mean, when I recorded my audio, yes, the producer would look up some words, but man, there was this one exhausting chapter that had like all the brain science in it, and it had the long names for chemicals and receptors in the brain. And I rehearsed those words knowing they were coming up. I did a pronunciation guide for myself knowing that these things were going to happen, and I'm not going to leave it to someone else to have to look those things up. So I went through the book before I recorded the audiobook and made sure that I knew how to say, and there were certain words, there was one in particular that I have been saying wrong my entire life. It was one of those moments where you realize, oh, I've been a doofus my entire life, and I've been saying this word wrong. It's always good for us to. I think it's like relying too heavily on a copy editor. I don't like
Serena.
To do that.
Do you think that audiobook narrators always read the book before they sit down and start reading it into the microphone?
No.
I had a feeling that was what you were going to say.
But the good ones, of course,
whatever.
Know their limits, and they know what they need to quickly look up and fix. I have also been sent exhaustive pronunciation lists from audio production companies that have made me giggle because some of the words on it, you know, are hilarious.
I'm telling you, though, those Vermont towns, they are hard to say.
I know. No one will ever get over the fact that Montpelier is pronounced incorrectly in Roommate by a very experienced narrator who is wonderful. Yeah. But, but Tanya told me once she had mispronounced, and I'm talking about Tanya Eby, who is a rock star. She mispronounced a Hawaiian word in a book and was sent it as a pickup because they can fix this stuff in post. So she had to go through and say the sentences over again where she had used this one word. The problem was this Hawaiian word was like 217 times in the book. So there, I believe that post was accompanied by a picture of the cocktail she was going to drink that night. But
that's funny.
It was, yeah. They can have their moments of, you know, great distress over pronunciation.
Well, and I have to just add really quickly, post for audiobook narrating is so hard because your voice gets tired over time. And it also you're more phlegmy at the beginning and blah, 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 blah. Your mouth gets drier over time. And you have to stand in exactly the same spot in order to get, you know, they have to get all of the elements the same when you say the pickup so that it will sound the same as it should sound for the rest of the book. It's not easy. So anyway, we are on such a total tangent. The Latinist by Mark Prinz, Serena Bowen's new book, which just left. Serena, what's the name of your new book that I'm listening to?
The Best Men.
The Best Men. I mixed it up with the other day I mixed it up with the prequel that you that you released as a little teaser before
Super Hot Wingman.
And I'm enjoying that very much. Super Hot Wingman.
Super Hot Wingman, we released the audio on YouTube because it's a freebie. So it's like, well, you know, we'll just make all those audio chapters, there's like 9 of them, into little videos and released it on YouTube, which was a super fun experiment. But while we're talking about pronunciation, I'm going to give you the book that I've been reading because I'm a little worried about how I'm saying the author's last name. But I just read a book called The Other Man by Farhad Dadiberger. And he is an author of a romance which takes place in India. And he was born and raised in Mumbai. And this is a very contemporary book about being a gay man in India and having a romance. And it's just so amazing. I loved my free ticket to his world and this, you know, very contemporary and all the restaurants and the cocktails. It was super fun and just different than the things that I am usually served up by the algorithms who rule my world. And I just really enjoyed my free ticket to his world. So I recommend The Other Man.
Well, I just finished, I'm grabbing it because it's sitting here, Olivia Dade's All the Feels, which is a companion, you know, it's I know that I have mentioned her earlier book, spoiler alert, and this is, I guess I would call it a companion. It's not exactly a series. You could read them in any order. But this is a super fun book, very body positive, and with a neurodivergent hero, which is a word that I was trying desperately to recall when I decided to post about this on Instagram and finally sort of ended up with, he thinks different. So neurodivergent is the word that I was thinking of. He's got ADHD. The hero in this book is so... It's so funny. I mean, he's a movie star, and please give me all the books about movie stars and regular people because that's a trope that I happen to adore. But what's really funny about him is that he just has this endless need to be entertaining. So you get the joy within the book of having him be endlessly entertaining, and then also sort of the reasons why he is like that. So All the Feels by Olivia Dade, very much a romance that, you know, two points of view, all the things, but lots and lots and lots of fun. No idea how the audio is, sorry, but hey, all the words in that title and her last name are super easy for me to pronounce.
KJ, you should listen to, or sorry, you should read Lily Chu's The Stand-In. It's another celebrity normal person book, except the normal person is acting as, I think I talked about it on a podcast before. It turns out that this superstar Chinese actress is just having she's just overwhelmed. And it turns out that there's a normal person in Vancouver who keeps getting mistaken for her, and paparazzi keep asking for her name for an autograph. And it turns out that she ends up being the stand-in just at like events and stuff like that for this super famous person.
It's really good. Absolutely, yeah. Up my alley.
Yeah, it's great.
Lily on Chu. On the list right here,
yeah.
Right now. Consider that done.
Okay.
All right. Well, That was episode 300, and you know, 301 is coming, and 302, and all the things are coming up next.
One of the things I've learned is that I love doing the coaching episodes. So if you need coaching on a particular, you're at a sticking point, you have a decision to make, you don't know what to do next, we love the coaching episodes. So either go, either email us at
amwriting@substack.com.
amwriting@substack.com. Go to the hashtag, go to the Facebook group, hashtag amwriting, but email us is probably the best way to go. And we would love to help you with your problem. I think it's that sweet spot of being a teacher that I love. I just love this stuff. It's so much fun. Go to the hashtag amwriting, the Facebook group, the hashtag amwriting Facebook group, because there's all kinds of wonderful writers there. We have a couple of thousand people who listen to the podcast and share their triumphs and their disasters and are just really honest about the process of writing. It's a really fun place to be. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Serena and KJ, for being my co-hosts, because it's been great. It's been so cool. I love being a part of this. And thank you all for listening. And until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Save. Pause. Stop. Stop.